Blog Talk Radio.
That's okay. I can handle this one.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you have done.
Good evening and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2737. That's 2737. My name is Carol Levine and I am Vice President of NASCA. Tonight is open mic night. And I want everyone to feel comfortable about calling in because we're speaking about alcoholism, okay? And believe me, I was a big alcoholic. I'll be an alcoholic till the day I die. I just don't drink. And sometimes it makes me very mad because I want to, but I won't do that. I've been in recovery since 1981, so I'm not going to mess that up. But anyway, so we have tonight Bill, our founder, who's going to be coming on. He's on right now, but I want to read the NASCA mission statement, okay? And he's actually the one that's going to be running the show tonight. I mean, I'm the co-host to him. And but anyway, okay, we have a singleness of purpose at NASCA to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so from two specific perspectives. Number one is educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting the facts that show child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. And believe me, it does. Number two is offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Okay, prevention, intervention, and recovery. Everyone knows who knows me that I many times zero in on prevention. However, the other two are equally as important. But tonight we're going to have a little different show. I believe that Bill's going to want to speak about the 12-step, okay? And I'll just read a little bit about him. You all know him, but it's an open mic, and tonight's special guest is Bill Murray. That's our founder from Los Angeles, and Bill's recovery is 12-step-based and spans some 3.5 decades. Sexually abused by numerous clerics, all men, between the ages of 11 and midway through high school, a minor seminary. He was also the victim of prepubescent pornography and even a two-week kidnapping. Bill was graced to have found Alcohol Anonymous and when he was 30 years old, he found that. The program not only helped him get clean and sober, but also gave him a place to give up his secrets and the tools by which he recovered. Now, I'm not going to read any more. I just want to bring forth a little bit of information in case there is someone out there who doesn't know our founder. It gives you a little bit of background. What we speak about on this show is child abuse, but also adult child abuse, okay? And in that sense, I mean those of us who were, as a child we were abused, and we are now adult survivors of child abuse. Very important. You can heal if you get the proper help, absolutely. You get on your healing journey, as I called it many years ago. And on that healing journey, it's not always the easiest thing to do. But once you say, I've had enough, I want to live my life, I want a life, then you put the work into it. You get yourself a very good therapist who understands child abuse. You come to shows like this here, Stop Child Abuse Now, and we talk about all the issues of child abuse. And that can be sexual assault, physical, mental, emotional, and neglect. The telephone number here is 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. And everyone out there, you know, remember, it was not your fault ever. Many, many of us turned to alcohol and drugs. So the shame and the blame is not with us. It is with those who abused us. Now I'm going to turn it over to Bill and see how he wants to start this show. Okay, Bill, you're on. And we also have Penelope, okay, and I'm so happy she called in. And so she'll be here, and she's from Washington, and I'm happy she's here. Okay, Bill, it's all yours. Are you there?
I had to open the microphone. You didn't do it.
No, okay. I have it open.
Yes, I am here.
It's red. Okay, go ahead.
I know, I just opened it.
Go ahead.
It. Well, thanks for the introduction,
go ahead.
Pal.
Don't worry about it. Just do
Thank
it.
You. Thank you for the introduction, Carol. Appreciate that. I'm not sure that we're going to talk about alcoholism. That's up to the people that want me or may not want me to talk about it. It's certainly one of the things that I can talk about because, I am an alcoholic. I'm a sober alcoholic for a long time. And I used the 12 steps in order to get sober, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I don't necessarily recommend that process for NASCA members. Some can, some do, and I have no problem if they want to do it. I did it, and it worked, but there are many ways, many paths to recovery, and that's just one of them. There's, as you said, there's therapies, and there's ministry, and there's counseling, and there's psychiatry, and there's all kinds of life coaches out there nowadays, other sober people who run sort of institutions, or they do therapy with people. There's lots of tools like hypnosis and EMDR and dance therapy and journaling and on and on and on, all kinds of things. And I stress that at NASCA we don't tell people what they have to do. We tell them what we've done, of course, but that doesn't mean that what we've done is the best way. It may not be the best way for somebody else. And so we explain all the different paths that are available, and we try and hook somebody up with what's appropriate for them or suggest how they can find the appropriate thing, and then we support them in whatever choices they make. So you might have a person who goes strictly religious on you. That's fine. You might have someone who's, really got some, besides the trauma problem, they have a mental disorder, so they need to go to a psychiatrist so they can get medication, and that's fine. You know, there are people who consider themselves, knowledgeable enough to call themselves a coach or a trainer, and you'll find them all over the website now, and that's fine if you find somebody. The point is, whoever you select or whatever you select, you want to make sure they really do understand the issues of child abuse, the abuse itself when it goes on, but also the reaction to it, which is trauma in its all its forms, because that's what you're trying to heal from. And so they have to understand trauma very well in order to help you overcome it and walk and get through it. And, you know, that really takes either some training or a lot of experience. And the training, by training, I mean professional training, can occur now in schools where psychology schools have training in trauma recovery. And the better psychology students nowadays for us are those that concentrate in that area. And then there are other areas, but this used to be difficult to find. It's no longer difficult to find. And that's great. That's a progress we've made. Now, the other thing that I do want to stress is although we don't necessarily follow or even recommend a 12-step recovery process, we do have what we call the 12 traditions by which we run Alcoholics Anonymous in terms of how we proceed with the organization. So it's not about the individual and their recovery. It's about keeping the organization running on track as far as having a set of spiritual principles by which we run. And they are on the front page of the website if people are interested in looking at them. And I think they should. Actually, I think they should study them. But, you know, we have a really full-fledged website, all kinds of things on here. And if you go to the front page of the NASCA.org website, below our mission statement, you'll see a couple of rows of things that bring you to other places. One of them is a red row of buttons. And when you hover your mouse over any of the five buttons in that red row, a whole bunch of buttons drop down, I think about eight or so for each one. So the one I want to draw people's attention to is the last button that says participate at NASCA. And then the second to last, I think it is, link there, it says the 12 traditions. And these 12 traditions have been rewritten so that they express the NASCA organization or the issue that we face, which is, of course, healing from child abuse and its trauma. So they're rewritten in that sense, but everything else is the same as it would be for any other group that uses the 12 traditions, which do come from Alcoholics Anonymous, but they're not about recovery. They're about keeping the organization on the straight and level. And they came about through trial and error of about 15 to 20 years of the first group of people that came into from 1935, which is when AA began, till around 1955, when about the 20th year they had a convention. And they have them every 5 years, an international convention. Anyway, they passed or ratified 12 traditions that had never been written down before. And this is what you're looking at here if you look at that page. So that is something that I do guide this organization by. And I call them the spiritual principles that by which we run. And I do recommend it. It's the thing that I fell in love with as far as a 12-step program. The AA program doesn't – I wish I didn't have to do the steps. You know, I did, but I wish I didn't have to. But I love the traditions, and I recognize them right away as kind of the guideline for which I would run pretty much everything I've done since. The organizations I've run and the chairmanship that I've run and all those kinds of things, even if I don't express it, this is the set of principles that I run them by. Now they're on the website, and for a few years now I've told people how NASCA came about and what what guides I had, these 12 steps, these 12 traditions. So I don't know, to go back, I don't know what exactly people want to talk about. I'm happy to talk about any and all of the things that I've already mentioned, or, of course, anything that has to do with NASCA or my story. So there's a lot of material out there that I'm happy to talk about, and I hope some people will call in and, query, whatever they'd like to. Ask us to discuss whatever they'd like to, and my life's an open book, so I'm willing to talk about anything at all. And so thank you for being here, Carol, and thank you, Penelope, for following up, too.
You bet. It's so important that people realize, and, of course, I had to come to that realization as well, just how detrimental alcoholism is to themselves and also to their families, okay? And I remember when I was in class, I made a professor very mad, Bill, very mad. We were role-playing, and I love to role-play and stuff like that. I'm a clown, and I really get into it. But
right.
He made the mistake as choosing me as the wife of an alcoholic. And I thought, does this man know me? because I was at that time the wife of an alcoholic and then an alcoholic myself. Now, this was from a clerical point of view. He was playing a priest, and he was there to talk to myself and to my so-called husband, the other player, and two of our children, the other players. And he was saying that, you know, it's a disease and that they can't be held accountable, they can't be held responsible, you know, for, you know, the way they behave. And you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to forgive them and all these things. And I was sitting there and I started to get mad, okay, because all the things that I knew about alcoholism, now I was a clown. I'm always a clown. People know me as a clown. But there are so many people out there who are not clowns, and what they do is they take out a very aggressive behavior style on their family and society in general, you know, as the disease, yes, of alcoholism progresses. So it's very important for people to realize that, you know, if you're an alcoholic, number one, you should get help for yourself, and also, too, if you have a family, your family is begging inside that you get help, because chances are you're a brute. You can be a brute at home. You absolutely can be. And I did look at some of the things because I always do an awful lot of research on a lot of different things. But a sexual assault is up 37%. And many times the people who are the abusers are under the influence of alcohol. Wow, I found this out. By the way, what I deal with is the American Academy of Addiction Psychiatry, and that can be typed right into your browser. And I'm going to use that, American Academy of Addiction Psychiatry, and then you have AAA, AAA underneath that. That deals with we, the survivors of those who were abused, you know, in the home. And I had the stats on that, too. It all comes from this organization. My God, it's so high. But, you know, the stats are really outrageous of how much abuse does happen at home. And many times, more often than not, people, there's alcohol, you know, involved with it. And so for this professor to speak the way that he was speaking, I came from an alcoholic background. My so-called father was a raging alcoholic and horribly abusive, and a lot of blood flying and other things flying too. And so the way he was portraying alcoholism, yes, it is a disease. However, and it is generational, it certainly can be. Sometimes it skips a member or two. But it's not something that you coddle. And so I said some things, and he got so mad, he walked out and slammed the door. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm never going to be certified here, you know, because I made him so angry. But he came back in, and we spoke about it. Alcoholism is something that changes the lives of the person who's the alcoholic and also the people that they come in contact with. And to be an alcoholic, it can affect all different areas of your life. It certainly affected mine, you know, and everybody else that I know who is an alcoholic. And, you know, the more you drink, alcohol actually is much more, causes much more aggression. Okay, you'll have a much more an aggressive personality than, say, like someone, and I'm not saying that people should do this, but someone who, you know, shoots up heroin because you watch them go on the nod, as we used to call it, the nod. And they're not aggressive at all, okay? But the alcoholic is a person who many times, like I said, will go home and turn into a monster in his own family. Now, what studies have shown, and again, if you look up that organization that I did mention, it's a good one to have, and I think you should put this down, Bill, and maybe even post it. It's American Academy of Addiction Psychiatry, and that's AAA in parentheses. The AAA is in parentheses. It speaks about what it does to the individuals, how it affects us. It can cause depression. You know, all kinds of anxiety. Kids are afraid, is mommy or daddy, because it can be mommy too. It's not just daddy. mommy can come home and she's going to be so horribly abusive, and how it affects you. It really breaks it down. And that's an easy page, an easy website to read, because it has the titles, okay? Depression, how alcoholism, you know, causes depression in the family and also in the alcohol. Many times the alcohol comes from a background where there's mental illness or there is, all different types of behavioral problems. So it's important for people to realize not to be ashamed if you're an alcoholic. I'm not ashamed. You just get help. That's all. And it's very, very important. That's very, very important. So let's talk to Penelope and see what she thinks about, you know, people who are alcoholics who, about getting help and so forth.
Yeah, well, thanks for calling on me. And I'm just, appreciative to be here tonight, and obviously for everything that Bill as the founder, bringing NASCA to fruition and as a resource for so many people. And so, I know it's our organization, but Bill is the roots. And so I just wanted to, to mention that I'm so grateful for that and to be a part of it. And I've learned a lot. And so getting to answer your question, I did not grow up in a home where there was any drugs or alcohol addiction, nor have I ever experienced drug or alcohol addiction myself. So I've learned a lot from NASCA, and I think that when we're talking about child abuse, when we're talking about childhood trauma or traumas, I know that it always comes up, the measures that we take to numb ourselves. We dissociate, we numb ourselves to different things. So alcoholism, drug addiction. So I know that Bill brought, we brought up the topic of it being a disease. In my own experience and from what I've observed, it's a symptom of a bigger issue. It's the result. I look back at my home now. There were no drug or alcohol addiction issues, but there were other numbing issues: food, hypervigilance, hoarding on my father's side. So I think it's really important because there's such a consistent in the stories I hear and in my own that we, to numb the pain, go to what we're drawn to or what's accessible for us or how we choose or what grabs us to escape. I don't know if it's a choice to escape. It's just a means to escape. Those tools that I learned through the 12 steps have helped me in my recovery. Not that I, like I said, had a drug or alcohol addiction, but I now know that there were other patterns of behavior that I had developed from a very, very early age that were deeply ingrained in me, that numbed me, that were problematic and interfered with my daily life. It's so important. It's so important. But I think for me, whatever the numbing mechanism is, it's important to recognize that I don't think it's a disease. I think it's because accountability came up, right? Accountability comes up a lot, ownership. And we may have not been accountable for the abuse that we suffered, but we're responsible for our own healing, and that's where the accountability comes in. So I think however you want to label it, is it a symptom or a disease? But I think we have to just deal with it, and we have to acknowledge that we have to deal with it. So I don't know if that answers the question or not, but that's been a big part of my own journey, and I hear it often. These are themes of stories in the guests that I hear on the show and other people that I know that are going through a similar journey.
Well, that's actually one of the steps, too. You have to understand is at one time, Bill, you'll have to and tell me which number it is, because I went to AA for a short period of time, okay? I wasn't, I had to, all right? As part of my counselors, they were working with me, and then they taught me how to be a counselor. But the point is this, and I was certified in alcohol and drug abuse, but here's the thing. I had to look at accountability, which is what you're referring to. And I did go to AA for a short period of time, and I wasn't quite, I was still in the alcoholic mind, and Bill knows what I mean by that. I was still a roughneck, okay, and I didn't want to really take advantage. I only went because I had to. It was a part of my healing to go to AA. But there is one of the steps, and Bill, you'll have to, again, tell me which one that is, where you have to do, you know, self. You have to look at self and say, okay, I'm responsible for this. And you have to make amends. If you've hurt someone, you go to that person and you ask for forgiveness. And if they don't want to forgive you, okay, at least you put your foot in front of the other and you tried. And, you know, so that's accountability. And that's something that we will have to do if you're going to actually work the program. Yes, we are responsible for certain things that we've done. I certainly was. And everyone is who's an alcoholic, and none of us have the same stories. And, yes, we do turn to alcohol and drugs. It's one of the many things that we turn to, you know, to numb that pain that you were referring to, because we don't know what else to do. We have no voice, okay? So I started drinking at a very early age, at the age of 13, and I didn't drink very much because even though it was available in the house, I had to sneak it. So, but by the time I was 16, I was a full-fledged drinker, and I am an alcoholic. I wasn't drinking situationally. Some people do that. I wanted my alcohol. I needed my alcohol. This is what I thought. In fact, one night when my older friends, because I always hung out with older people, and of course they'd get me my alcohol, they decided that one night they weren't going to let me drink. And I totally freaked. Totally. And I don't know why I did this, but I went into the gas station. We stopped to get gas. And I had a bottle of aspirin in my purse, and I took out a handful. I couldn't tell you how many they were, and I popped them. And I was quite sure, about, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes later, whatever, that I felt better. So you see, that's the alcoholic mind. We're trying to numb always the pain. And a child abuse puts us in a situation where you have so much pain, whether it be physically, mentally, emotionally, just like all the things we read right off from the mission statement. I know it by heart now. I don't have to read it really. But, you know, the point is we're trying to address how we feel. And so we use the alcohol and the drugs or pills or whatever, you know, whatever we have. So, yeah, in that sense, you're completely right because it is a numbing effect. It's a numbing effect. What about with you, Bill? You you had an awful lot of things that you, too, wanted to numb.
Well, I think the use of anything obsessive or compulsive is an attempt to not feel whatever I'm currently feeling. So you could call it numbing, but you can also do some of these things that bring you a tremendous amount of excitement because at least for a period of time, you get out of the doldrum, the depression of whatever your life is, and you get into an exciting space. It doesn't last, but just like alcohol doesn't last, it works for a little while, and then you crash. And I'm thinking of things like, for example, if you have a gambling addiction, you do that because, you know, you need to come up, you know, and gambling gives you the illusion that, you know, things could get better. And you just got to try the next time and the next time and the next, you know, hand or the next bet. And sooner or later, you're going to win. Well, none of those games are set up for you to win. They're all set up for the casino to win or whatever. But you still do it because you are attracted to that high of the bet itself. And so there's lots of reasons that people do obsessive and compulsive things. Alcoholism, they call it a disease because it does involve implication that there is a physical difference between the person that's an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic. And that is that the alcoholic has an allergy, they call it, to drinking, to booze. And the regular person does not. So the regular person can drink for a while. You know, they're not that interested. They may occasionally get drunk, but they don't really like it. So they stop. Well, alcoholics find out they really like it, so they go as far as they can. They keep going and keep going and keep going. And then you can't stop. The reason it's called an allergy is because once you set up that cycle of an attraction to the high and that it's gained through alcohol or drugs, you know, you find it hard to escape because that's what you're after then from then on. You want to change how you feel when you're not using drugs or alcohol, so you use drugs or alcohol. And at a certain point, you cross the line, if you want, that it's nearly impossible for someone who's gotten to that point with their drinking experience to get sober by themselves. And they need, like, the organization, like the community of Alcoholics Anonymous, or in our case, the community of NASCA, which we call the NASCA family. It's a community. And that's really what that's why NASCA works, because as a community, we support each other. And we have a myriad of experiences and backgrounds, and you will eventually find somebody who's got a very similar background to yours. You know, right. Many of us tell our stories on these shows, or we write books, or we make appearances at workshops and things that right now aren't being held because of COVID, but they'll come back, seminars and so forth. And we testify about where we were, what we did, and now where we are today. So it's those three aspects. It's where we used to be when we were all beat up and horribly, you know, upset about what had happened to us as children. And what we did about it often does include at least bad behavior. It may not be drinking and using, but it's a change in our behavior that, you know, it's kind of crossing that line, the behavior line, the attitude line. And when we can do that for quite some time before it catches up to us, but we can't get away from it. Because you can't escape once you're traumatized as a kid and you're now a young adult and then you become a regular adult, you can't escape it. You can't stop thinking about it, which is what our friends and families tell us to do. You can't. You know, it's in your brain, it's in your soul, it's in your body, and you can't escape it. So the only way to escape it that we know, or the best way we know, is to come together and realize that we're not alone, because that's another hallmark feeling that nobody will ever understand, because after all, nobody's ever gone through what we've gone through. Well, that's not true, but we don't know that until we encounter a NASCA organization, something like that. And here there are thousands of people who will easily and readily tell us you're in the right place, you know, don't just keep coming back, don't worry about what you were taught in years past, just keep your mind open, take the pieces you can that for now and use them for now, and maybe later you can use other things. But there's so much here at NASCA that there's something for everybody to be attracted to, at least one or two things early on, and eventually there's dozens of things that, you know, once our mind opens up a little and we kind of realize that, oh my God, this is the kind of thing I've been looking for and I couldn't find. You know, a group like this. And so that's what NASCA is. And it's not a 12-step program. It is a 12-tradition program whereby we follow those 12 traditions that I told you where to find them that are designed to keep us online. And the many things, if you read the 12 traditions, you'll recognize many of the things that we do at NASCA come directly from the 12 traditions. In fact, all of them do. We don't break any of the traditions. Now, as far as the going back to those, since you wanted to speak about the 12 steps, the part of the 12 steps that talks about our responsibility, if you want, it's called taking inventory. It's step four.
Mm-hmm.
Take your fears
right.
and you know, inventory, moral inventory of ourselves. And then step five, once we've got it written down, we have to share that inventory with, usually it's our sponsor. It could be a therapist or somebody else, or a priest,
mm-hmm.
somebody we trust. Because within the telling of their of our inventory, we reveal a lot about ourselves, a lot. And as the more complete of an inventory that one does, the more they'll talk about in the fifth step, and they'll get some direction in the fifth step that takes you to the sixth and seventh step, which where you find is there's some people on the list of people that you've been talking about or things that you've talked about that you owe an
mm-hmm.
amends to, which you did mention, Carol. Amends
mm-hmm.
meaning you try to make reparations for things you've done. The 12 steps is not about the other person. It's about you. It's about you. And you're not asking the other person or anything in the world to change. In fact, early on, you are asked to suspend the illusion that anything has to change in order for you to get better. You know, you're asked to accept powerlessness, that you, no matter how much you struggle, you can't force your way into recovery. You know, but you can work your way into it if you do these steps in the order that they're laid out. They were created by the first 100 people that got sober, and they've worked for since 1935. Millions and millions and millions of people worldwide have used the same steps, and then they've also borrowed them for other organizations like Narcotics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous and Smokers Anonymous
mm-hmm.
and, you know, Gamblers Anonymous and Overeaters Anonymous. They're all the same. They all use the same process because you're not trying to escape alcohol. You're trying to escape your behavior. Because if you fix your behavior, the reasoning is you won't need to do alcohol anymore. Because you'll never come to that place where you hate yourself so much that you think the only thing you can do is change how you feel by doing the substance. So, you know, you get clean and sober, and then you have to stay clean and sober by doing the steps, which involve your own inventory, you know, your own making of a list, your own reparation making, which we call amends, and then, you know, in the process of making amends, a myriad of things happen that are miraculous. And the sort of the end of the 12 steps is, we call them maintenance steps. There's 10, 11, and 12 have to do with the fact that we want to keep taking inventories, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. We need to do prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand him. And then finally, 12 is having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, the 11 before it, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics, or in our case, to other people who have trauma, and help them. So it's a service step. The 12th step is always service step. So this is why the 12 steps work for us, but you don't have to use the 12 steps. There's, you know, many, many people who get into recovery by using, you know, talk therapy or journal therapy or, you know, whatever, group therapy. And it's therapy. It's not a recovery process, but it's therapy. And over time, they do get better. And that's what we want. And we just simply want you to improve and have a life that, you know, by which over time you earn the opportunity to have a quality of life that you've never experienced before and perhaps thought you never could have. See, that's what people are amazed by. They thought they would never escape this thing that's inside of them that was the result of their child abuse, and that's the trauma that's inside of us. And it manifests in so many different ways. And it's everything from small things like having nightmares when we sleep to the hatred that we feel about a certain whole classified group of people. I've heard of women that hate all men because their perpetrator was a man. But I've also heard of, you know, it's the opposite, that some men hate all women because their mother was their perpetrator, was their sexual abuse person. And, you know, so that's like blaming the entire group of people for the behavior of one or a couple. I blamed for a while, you know, the Catholic Church and every person that was in it, certainly all the priests, because many of the people that molested me were priests and brothers. And I didn't understand that what I was really angry at was not priests. I was angry at pedophiles who happened to be priests. You know, big difference. But I didn't know that for a long time. And I did not know it until I was in recovery, and then it occurred to me. So I had to get into recovery to start, you know, seeing that the truth is that I was wrong in a lot of situations, and that's what I was here to fix. If I could fix the stuff, correct the stuff, I don't say fix, but correct the stuff, straighten out my life, make reparations, and admit when I was wrong in the future, too. So when I'm wrong, I promptly admit it if I can. I try to, as soon as possible, even now, you know, admit when I'm wrong and, you know, and fess up to it and ask the persons that I think might be hurt, you know, what can I do to correct this? And I also make them the commitment that as best I can, I'm going to be aware of this behavior and not repeat it again, you know. So that's what amends are, all of that. You know, it can go on for years. I mean, my amends list was huge. But I found I was able to make amends, direct amends, for more than half the list pretty fast, within 2 or 3 years. And the rest of it, I've had to wait sometimes till I can find the reason to make the amends or the person to make the amends or something like that. But right now, I don't have, there's no mess of stuff on my shoulders anymore, you know. I was weighed down by, you know, all the character defects and shortcomings that had made me do bad stuff. Now, I know I still have character defects and shortcomings, and sometimes I will imbibe in them. You know, but imbibing in them is not like, you know, is not like getting myself completely immersed in them, and that's what I used to do. So no more immersion. Occasional touching on.
Well, I think you're doing fine. I think you're doing fine, Bill. Yes, I do. You know, there's so many things though that people have to realize. I mean, I realized that I needed help. Okay. When my fingers started to bloat and my kidneys started to pound, and it affected me physically. And the strange part of this is I was working in detox as a counselor. I never looked at myself as an alcoholic because, you see, I was functioning. I was going to school because I had to, didn't want to, but they made me go to Princeton. And a nurse also that worked with me, an RN. We had to have more credits. So anyway, I realized that one day I couldn't drink anymore. I was starting to get sick. And I couldn't even have a glass of wine. Not me. I couldn't even have a glass of wine and without my kidneys pounding. And so I realized that, okay, I've seen many, many, many grand mal seizures because detox, they didn't help you by giving you any type of drug to make it easier on you. We had a lot of people come over from Staten Island. I was working in Perth Amboy. And believe me, those people were hardcore, very, very, very hardcore. And so they were, as they called it then, poly-addicted. It's dually addicted. With the alcohol and the drugs, okay? So yeah. They would go into terrible, terrible seizures. And our detox center was a part of the hospital, which was right across the street. I worked for the hospital. We all did. But we had detox on the side. So when they had these terrible seizures, if their vital signs didn't go back down to normal, we would take them across the street. Okay, we'd have an ambulance come over and pick them up. And they'd give them a shot, okay? And it would calm them down, and then they'd go back inside, you know, to detox. And we being the counselors, what we had to do was to try and get them into programs. And some of them had good insurance, in other words, didn't have any insurance. The ones that didn't have insurance went to the Salvation Army. And the Salvation Army has a thrift shop where you work downstairs, and they had housing upstairs. But they all went to AA. They had all their AA meetings. And, of course, we ran AA meetings, and we also put clients into the vans and took them to other AA meetings off the grounds and so forth and off the street. So, you know, it was a very good experience working there. But I didn't realize that, hey, dummy, you're really one of them. You know, I didn't.
Yeah, but you know, I want to make, let me make a point here because I don't want people to get misinformed.
Well,
either.
Go ahead.
I never went to a detox. Never. Never went to a detox. Never spent
the
night in a drunk
tank. That was going to be my next question. Yeah.
I never did. I never went to treatment. I used to resent people that went to treatment because they had somehow they had insurance or something. And back then, you know, if you had if you had the right insurance, they would bring you into a relatively, you know, calm place to rest. I saw it as place to rest. You got fed three times a day. They changed your sheets. You got to go to meetings, you know, a comfortable place and so forth. I didn't have any of that. I was living in on the street or in my van. And the first couple of months of my recovery, I resented the hell out of people that I saw walking back and forth to the treatment center that was local, which was at Cedars-Sinai. And they were coming to my meeting in the morning and then going back to their comfortable place and having breakfast or whatever. So I just,
that's right.
I didn't experience my liver falling out of me or my fingers getting puffy or any of that. What I experienced was somebody broke their anonymity with me. And when they broke their anonymity with me, I kind of identified what they were talking about. But I was surprised they considered themselves an alcoholic because they didn't drink any worse than I did. And they convinced me over time to try one of these places, these AA meetings. And I showed up. And I resented the hell out of that, too. But I was a person that kept my promises. In spite of all the character defects I have, I was a promise keeper. So if I made you a promise, I would keep it up. And I made this man a promise, who's a friend of mine. And I showed up, and I couldn't believe what I saw. And, you know, Carol knows this, but the typical AA meeting, you know, if it was a speaker meeting, which this was, it usually has people who are sober quite some time, a matter of years, who are in the audience, and somebody who gives a talk who's definitely got a fairly long-term sobriety, and they give – some of them are really fabulous speakers. And I heard one of those speakers that night. It just impressed the hell out of me. And I – you know, so the point I'm making is I didn't lose – I mean, I lost my job, but I lost it after I got sober because I found out – that without the drink, I was functioning great on drugs and alcohol.
Right.
I had
right.
a business. I had a family.
I'm sorry.
I had clients. Yeah. I had you know, all these things going on in my life. I had equipment. I had the van. I had all kinds of things going on. I had customers. I had a small business that was successful. It was about to go into the next level. And when I got sober, I couldn't do any of that. And so I lost all that. I lost the relationship, I lost the business, I lost the bank account, because my partner went in and just emptied it out and took it with her.
oh, geez.
And my life was horrible for the next couple of years because I had to go back. My life has been going backwards ever since, to be honest. The only thing that's moved forward, though, is my sobriety, my recovery. Because, as I said, there was not an opportunity for me to talk about child abuse. Well, I didn't say it just now, but I've said it before. I could not find any kind of counselor or person who could help me with the child abuse issue. They all considered boys to be incapable of being molested. So back then, the psychiatrists and psychologists had no process for us men, us young men. Mm-hmm. And I was 30 years old. But when I fell into Alcoholics Anonymous, I decided I was going to use the process that they were recommending, since they said this is not about stopping drinking. It's a design for living that really works. And I saw those other places borrowing the same 12 steps and having success. So I said, well, if they can do it and it's a design for living, it means you change your life, but you get better, then I'll use it for my trauma. And that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
So I both got, you know, sober and clean, but I also got, I started to heal when I was in my 30s, early 30s. And I've been constantly doing it ever since, you know. So I just don't want people to think there's any pat way to identify your alcoholism. And there's no reason, and there's no, you know, don't feel bad if you've not been influenced by alcohol. Because a lot of people will say, you know, the way they'll say it, it sounds like you have to be an alcoholic if you've had this happen to you. Well, no, you don't. There's a lot of different paths to take as a traumatized young adult. And we've tried them all, we at NASCA. So rest assured that someday, if you keep listening to these shows, you're going to hear a show with somebody's story that's very close to your story. And we want you to come in and tell your story, of course, too. So, you know, that's what I want to make sure they understood.
Absolutely. Everybody's different, Bill. Some people, you know, they don't have seizures. Other people do, and so forth. I mean, that's just the way it is. And you don't know who, you know, you can be speaking to a person and talking completely normal with that individual, and then, boom, just like that, right in front of your eyes, they go into a seizure. But that doesn't mean that everyone's going to do that, okay? But I came to the realization, because my health was deteriorating at a very early age, that I had to do something about it. And so that was part of what they helped me with at that church, probably one of the only good, really good Catholic churches, you know, with the counselors that were there. But what the heck was I going to ask you? Oh, yes. No, I was going to make a comment. You said something that really hit home, because when I was drinking, actively drinking, first of all, I'd never drank in front of my children. Remember, I'm the functioning alcoholic. I was a good mommy, and the daddy and I both drank together, but he was a monster, so I left him. But I didn't stop drinking, and he didn't either, but I was always the clown, so I didn't hurt anyone. But my children's clothing were laid out, their meals were made, their homework was done, we'd have TV time, you know, like watch Mr. Ed, oh my God, those goofy programs, you know. And then they'd take their showers, and they would be tucked in more or less for the night, and they allowed for them to read a book. They're a little bit older, you know, so they read their own books. And I would go downstairs. I was upstairs in an apartment complex, and we would all congregate right in front of my door. That way the kids were just upstairs. So, you know, this is how I did it, and I didn't realize that even though I was drinking like a maniac, that I was an alcoholic. It never occurred to me. So when I realized I had to stop, and I stopped myself, I took 3 days off. I had vacation time. I took three days off, put the kids someplace safe, and I stayed home, and I didn't know what was going to happen because of the things I'd seen, okay? But I don't believe that I had any problems. I certainly didn't have a seizure or anything. But going back to work, okay, 3 days later, on the fourth day, what happened was I was so different. They were used to a certain Carol. Now, you see, you brought forth something to me because I was the clown, like I said, always high and jovial. I take the high away. I wasn't drinking at work. I was jovial, you know, and the funny gal. And, you know, the flirty gal and all this other stuff, and guys that flirt with me and all this other stuff, and you know, but happy. I was happy. I really thought I was happy. And I would run really, really good groups, too. So to not have the alcohol as a crutch, all of a sudden I started coming in touch with who Carol really was. And it wasn't a pretty thing for me to feel. I was depressed. I was, you know, I wasn't as certain about myself as I had been before. I just felt different. So that alcohol that I started to drink at the age of 13, because I was having terrible panic attacks and all kinds of things, and, you know, and I continued to have panic attacks until the age of 49. I was not working at that place at that time. But I was able to function, you know, as a counselor. I did well. And but then as when the sun went down, yes, then the bottle came out, you know, and I was a heavy beer drinker. And I felt actually a sense of loss. I don't know if you felt that or not. I don't know if other people feel it. But maybe also, too, a sense of panic that I wasn't going to have my crutch, my alcohol. You know, it's like the night I popped a lot of aspirin, and I don't know how many I popped, but I was sure I felt better, you know, years before. And so alcoholism is really a terrible thing that a person goes through themselves, is what I'm trying to get across here. And yes, if you drink excessively and if you have an abusive type of, you know, way about you, then yes, you can cause a lot of problems in your family, and you can certainly cause a lot of problems in society. You'll have problems with, you know, your peers maybe at work, and things like that. So, but you can heal. You can heal. And you did it through AA. And I'm proud of you. Yes, I am.
Well, I didn't have a choice. There was nothing else. You know, I mean, it was really, it was like a boat will select any harbor it can find. That's the only thing that was available for me. You know, any port in a storm, right? There was
right.
nothing else. Now there are choices, which is why I would never recommend that people have to do anything. They don't have to do anything. There's a lot of choices.
Mm-hmm.
And we
mm-hmm.
will support a person no matter what it is that they do select for themselves or choose
mm-hmm.
for themselves. And by the way, picking something, you know, now is not necessarily the thing that you're going to, you know, stay with maybe next year or something. You know, in other words, these are temporary choices because you can always change choices. You can always change.
Mm-hmm.
You can always modify. You can always add something, you know, and a lot of people do that. So, but you're not. Here at NASCA, we don't require anything. I guess that's what I want to say. We don't require anything, which is a big relief for a person that needs recovery. We often come into these things thinking, oh, my God, what are they going to ask me to do? What are you going to make me do, right? How much is it going to cost me? It doesn't cost anything, okay, first of all. It costs nothing. For all the projects that we produce and support, zero cost. And we're all volunteers, and we work for no money, you know. So people are shocked because they expect to be told, well, it's going to be $100 a week or something, whatever it is, in other places.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing, we don't charge them a thing. They also are told, you have to buy this book, or you have to buy these books, a series of things.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't. You know, there are many books that we have a book list of things that are available by some of the authors that have come through the SCAN show, the show that we're on now, including yours, Carol. And they are listed on the website. And, you know, anybody who wants to find out what book Carol wrote, they go to L for Levine and on the list, and they will find Carol Levine, Panic Child, and how to order it. You know, so we have a lot of books that are available, but none of them are required is the point. None. And
no.
So it's a big relief when a newcomer comes in and is told that there are no rules. There really aren't any rules. I mean, the basic rule is, you know, in deference to being an adult, kind of, you know, don't be a jerk. You know, that's pretty much it.
as long as
you behave, and it's an adult. You know, we ask people to have adult behavior, but they can also have adult language and adult themes. I mean, we talk about anything we want here because all of our people who belong are 18 and older. They're all adults. So you want to talk about rape? You can. You want to talk about I don't know, oral sex, you can, you know, whatever you want. Mm-hmm. You're not going to shock anybody here because you're allowed to talk about stuff like that, stuff that you would not feel comfortable sharing somewhere else, but you can do it here. And you can
That's true.
A lot of ways. You can do it in the privacy of your own home, calling one person at a time if you want to do it that way. You can do it on Facebook. You can create a screen name that's not your name, but you, then you can have a persona on Facebook that's writing things, and people will get to know that persona, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
You can use your own name. You can use anything you want, but we do protect people who need anonymity because that's one of the traditions too. We don't require it, but we don't deny that for some people it's really important to be anonymous, especially when they're, you know, in early recovery. They don't want their parents to know or whatever.
You know what's good, Bill? I didn't mean to cut you off, but I don't want to lose that train of thought. Now, what you're saying is right.
No problem.
And the reason being why I want to bring this out is, you know, whether it be NASCA, okay, or whether it be the recovery groups. Now, I have not gone on to the recovery groups. I'm very dedicated to NASCA. It doesn't mean that those groups I don't have interest in them. I'm busy. I'm a busy person. And I stick a lot with research and also homeless when I can do it, okay? But anyway, the point is this. We're very laid back. I tell people about our show. And you know, people don't have to feel intimidated. Tonight we're talking about, you know, recovery, you know, and AA and all other types of things that have to do with it. And that's good for people to hear because there are people listening right now who depend on that, you know, those glasses of wine, those bottles of beer, and all that other stuff. And, you know, we don't require that people do anything, like you said, but we suggest we have programs. There are programs. There is, of course, AA. And then also, too, I had a man, I'm not going to say who he was, on the phone a few days ago. And he's just gotten back home. But anyway, I was on the phone, and the phone rang, and he may even call me tonight. I don't know. But the point is this. We don't make demands. People don't have to speak about certain subject matter, just things that are on their mind. They can sit and they can listen. They can relax. This is a place where people can come to relax and also learn a lot of things. And with the recovery groups, from what I've been told, that's very much, you know, the way that it is there, too. You go and people, you know, they can socialize. Sometimes that's a big thing for people with the socialization skills because many times people don't have that. And so then they go to the groups and they can have socialization skills. They start to feel comfortable for the first time maybe in years. All right, they're feeling comfortable, okay. And then they talk about issues. Again, our stories are not always the same, but we can identify with a lot of each other's stories. And that makes them comfortable, too. And then, too, on the front page of the website, we do offer programs that you and Caroline, I believe it was, put together, Caroline from the UK, where people can go to those type of programs also. And it's very simple
right.
to do. That's the first one on the left-hand side. And
right.
I don't think you moved it. I haven't looked at it lately, but it was the first one on the left-hand side. And that gives you like an option. You can go to there. You find the state that you're in. Remember, we're worldwide, so you're going to find other countries as well, but all English-speaking, if I remember correctly. But then underneath you have the United States. And find wherever you're from. Right now I'm living in New Jersey, all right? And so I would look up New Jersey, and I would go to maybe my county or a town near where I live, or maybe even in my town, okay, right in my town. And a lot of times there's groups going on that people don't even realize. Okay, they don't actually advertise it. Hey, there's groups here. They don't have signs outside or anything. But I've had many, many, many people call me, and they were so happy that they have NASCA, found NASCA, and then also, too, those groups. Okay? So that's something to keep in mind also. They're very good. They're very effective. Sometimes you might have three in a nearby area of where you live. And you might find you prefer one group over another. That's fine. And you get help that way too. So what you and Caroline have put together is an amazing tool to have, because people can use that as well. And then, of course, on the Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays, I'm just telling people who are listening who maybe don't quite know, we do have the people that come on, and we have this platform open, and you can tell your story. I've gotten a lot of feedback from people who told their story, and 99% of them are happy that they did it, okay?
Oh, yeah.
And they find that, they find that to be very, very helpful, very helpful. So, you know, it's a good thing. It's a good thing that you've created here, Bill. It really is. And I was going to call on Penelope, but I see she dropped off. Maybe she had to do something. But, no, it's this NASCAR. I had someone, that man I was speaking about a few minutes ago, he said, NASCAR is a wonderful thing. He said, I've listened, and I've learned a lot. And I don't know if I can, you know, have him come on and tell a story. That's up to him. But remember, we don't always just speak about sexual abuse. It's physical, mental, emotional, sexual abuse, and neglect. And some of us have gone through it all. Others haven't. And it doesn't matter if you were abused one time or if you were abused well over 100 times. Trauma is trauma. But one thing we do know through studies is that if you were abused more than, well, say more than five times, and that's maybe, they even say less than that, it can turn into complex PTSD, because a lot of these phone calls I receive, they talk about PTSD because they'd been diagnosed with it, and they want to talk, you know, about it. And that's why we have the show, too, is because of the abuses. So many things can it can affect us emotionally, physically, mentally, spiritually, you know, all these things. We did not ask to be born. I always say this. And I certainly, and nor did you or anyone else who's a part of NASCAR, did we ever ask, you know, for people to abuse us. I don't care what the situation is, okay? And even if at times, like we had someone on not too long ago, but they thought they were sort of like in a normal situation, not really, you know, realizing that they were being abused, and they just thought it was sort of like normal. And then finally they realized that it's not normal to be abused, okay? So they find out things just by listening to our show. So I'm very thankful that, you know, that you have put together such a very good website. And then also, too, now we have, like, the little satellites, that's what I call them, you know, the recovery groups. And so that's good, too. That's good, too, Bill.
Yeah, I envisioned that NASCAR could become sort of an umbrella for many groups and many individuals who could do their own thing off to the side, but then always have, you know, the NASCAR organization to come back to, because anybody is a member of NASCAR if they say they are. So we don't even have a rule about registering or paying any dues. And so that means that people are free to, to go and come, frankly, and do what they want. Mm-hmm. And we will support them and not only support them, but encourage them to do that, you know. And we're going to be here, I hope. NASCAR, I think, will be here. I believe we have, gone past the place where we'll survive, and we're going to keep growing. So, we want the fresh input that comes from people who go outside our organization and then bring those experiences back. And by the way, you know, you hear your story, I said, eventually, and it makes you identify and perhaps make you available for your own, telling your own story, because this is important. I want to clarify that. You may not hear the facts of your story, but you're going to hear the patterns and the feelings and the and the actions. And what I mean by that is, you know, you may hear somebody talk about the obsession that they had, and they were an alcoholic, but your obsession is to eating, to overeating.
Right.
And you realize, wow, I am obsessive. You know, and most of us are, but we don't think of it that way. We think of ourselves as being broken, kind of, you know, of having disorders. But this is where we're similar, is in how we feel, how we act, our decisions, who we choose as partners in life, or, you know, and we don't do a very good job with that. Our career paths and so forth, how we deal with our families, you know, especially if we were abused in our families, which 2/3 of us are, you know, and, you know, this is just mind-blowing stuff. So you may not hear the exact facts of your story. You may, but you will certainly feel all that universal stuff that we all have, the choices we make and the decisions and the patterns of behavior and so forth. And you're going to hear that over and over and over because that's our similarity. So I just wanted to make that plain. But
well, you know,
we come from
what
every
you
walk
says,
of life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we do come from every walk of life. You know, you don't have to be poor. You don't have to be rich. You don't have to be somewhere in between. Anyone can get abused as a child. And that's something that I always talk about with people, too, you know. And so was that you or the dog? What was that? I heard a noise.
Dog.
Are you there? Bill?
It was the dog saying hello to mommy. Yes, it was the dog.
Oh, okay. Okay. But, yeah, no, that's something that's true, too, because people don't realize. They always think, or at least many times, I'm not going to say always, but many times they think that, you know, the kids that are abused are going to be the ones that come from, you know, the slums, as they used to say, the slums, right? The urban kids, the kids from the city. Wealthy kids get abused, too. I just want to make that clear because I came from a wealthy family, and although I was treated as though I was nothing like I was wallpaper, we've spoken about that before on shows, an object that was in the house but not real, and I had no voice, all these things that we speak about. But, yeah, if you realize how much money that was involved, I certainly should never have been treated like that. So it doesn't matter if you're a wealthy kid or a kid that comes from a wealthy home or whether you're a kid that is from the urban area. You're an urbanite, okay? You're from New York, which is where I was born, all right? And quite frankly, I really prefer the city. I really do. I really miss the city. I have to admit that, Bill. Because sometimes I walk around this house. I'm very much in the country. And I feel like I'm in prison. I really do. I feel like I'm like in the, you know, I'm tucked away. You know, it's too quiet. And when they talk about the pulse of the city, there's a reason for that because some people actually feel vibrant. They feel more alive. They feel well. You're from New York, right?
Yes, I am. Yes, originally.
Yeah. Well, how did you feel like when you were in the city? Did you know? You know what I'm talking about. There's stores all over. There's all different kinds of. You know, you have all kinds of things all over the place that you can go and go through. You know, in Brooklyn, you had the zoos and all this other stuff. I mean, wherever you come from the city, I mean, it's too vast to start. You know, naming things. And of course, you have Broadway. I was nuts about Broadway. Broadway, I think, has come back. I've seen over 50 Broadway shows. And so to me, the city has a pulse, and to me, it's a happier place for me to be. I have to admit that.
Sure.
So,
sure.
You know, I mean, I don't know. I might move. Yeah, I might move because I don't like being so secluded here. To me, it's not a fun place to be. But, again, getting back to what we were talking about, you know, people have their good days, they have their bad days. Now, there are days, I still have to admit, where I will think about, you know, gee, I wish I could just pop open a beer, you know, just have one beer. But I know I can't do that. You know, can't do that. And, you know, I'm not going to get into the type of person where maybe I can say I could be a controlled drinker. I do know of alcoholics that do that, though, where they feel, well, I can control it. I'll only have three or two or three. And they seem to do fine on that. I don't like saying that, but they seem to do fine on that. I would not do fine on that because if I have one, I would want another, and then I want another, and then I want another, and on we go. But let me ask you something. When did you actually realize it was through someone talking to you, you said, that you were an alcoholic? What made you cross the line and say, hey, I'm an alcoholic? We know what happened to me.
This person was... he was about 3 months sober. I found out later, but he was telling me about how wonderful it was to be sober, and he was talking and talking. We had gone to a job together, and we were both television people, and we went out and we shot a commercial with at the theme park, which was like the safari theme park, and the actors that were in the thing were the Raiderettes. They were the girls that were the cheerleaders for the Raiders. And the day was horrible. It went terribly. Everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. It rained. We had equipment failures. We had my truck was damaged. All kinds of stuff happened. And so we stopped at a restaurant on the way back home and ate some dinner. And I remarked to him, because he had told me he was an alcoholic, I remarked to him, hey, if you're an alcoholic, go ahead and order a beer. It's okay. He said, oh, no, I'm an alcoholic, but I don't drink anymore. And I said, what? What are you talking about? And he started to explain it. To be honest with you, I asked him about these meetings he was talking about. Was there one I could go to? Because I wanted him to shut up. I just wanted him to shut up. He was talking. He was a professional. He knew everything about it. Blah, 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 blah. And I finally said, well, listen, is there one of these meetings next week or something in town? And he said, well, yeah, there's one next week. And so, make a long story short, that's where we left it. But I made the commitment, as I said, that I would show up at a meeting. And when I make a promise, I keep it. The promise I'd made was that I'd let him pick the meeting, and then I'd show up to meet him there with his girlfriend. And that's what I did. So the first meeting I went to was the result of my wanting him to get quiet, you know, just be quiet. And let me eat, you know, go home. It was a horrible day. And I went to this meeting maybe a week later, and it was a meeting with 250 people in it and a really good speaker, and it really impressed me. Now, I didn't get sober from that moment, but I did hear enough in the several meetings that I went to over the next couple of weeks that I knew I was supposed to stop drinking and if I could. But I knew I couldn't. I thought I couldn't. But I did it anyway. And I did some controlled drinking, and I basically proved to myself that I couldn't stop by myself. I put a beer in the refrigerator and looked at it overnight, didn't drink it. So the next day I drank it and nothing happened. And I put two beers in the refrigerator the next night and I looked at them and then I eventually drank them and nothing happened. And I said, well, geez, I might as well get drunk. And I got drunk the next day and that's when something happened. I couldn't stop. And I couldn't believe I couldn't stop. I went on to marijuana maintenance for several weeks and I couldn't stop that either. So I went back to these meetings that I had gone to before, and this would be about perhaps 6 months after I was introduced to AA. I came crawling back into what became my morning meeting, a 7:30 in the morning meeting, and I just kind of surrendered, which means I gave up trying to do it my way. And I admitted that I didn't know what I was doing. I couldn't do it by myself. I asked for help and so forth, and that's when I got it. So it was, I'm of the educational variety.
That's all right. You did it. You did it.
Yeah.
You did it.
Yeah.
You did it.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't stay in the program, but I detoxed myself, and I already worked there for so long. I detoxed. I figured I know how to do this. They would hand them vitamin B pills. That's what the nurses did there. When someone came into detox, they handed them vitamin B pills because they felt that they were so they had problems, deficiency in vitamins. They were deficient because a lot of times alcoholics don't eat right. Okay, all they want to do is drink.
Right.
So that's the only thing they offered, and so that's why so many of them had the seizures and so forth. There wasn't any come down type of medication to calm the nerves, and over the course of the street they went. But, there's so many people that I know in my family that I learned, were alcoholics. They were closet drinkers. And even with my grandmother, my mother's side, now that's true blood on that side because my mother was my mother. So her mother would have been my grandmother. But I used to hear stories about they were on a farm. They owned a farm in Iowa. And evidently, the boys, my mother's brothers, and my grandfather, after dinner, out to the barn they'd go. And my grandmother would go running out there with a stick of some sort. I don't know. That's probably where my mother got it from. But anyway, she was going to hit all of them because she knew they were drinking. You see, there was a lot of drinking on that side of the family, too. So it does happen. It does happen in families. And this is what we speak about so often. A lot of things happen in families. A lot of things are generational. A lot of abuse happens in families, because they were abused. But it's never, ever, ever, ever right. And that's one thing I was speaking about with this guy the other night, because he said, well, my parents went through it. It was generational where they were abused. It wasn't sexual. It was physical. And but it doesn't matter. It's abuse. Trauma is trauma. And I think one is equally as bad. Remember one of the last shows I did, I really do have to think about this. Sexual abuse is horrific. But if you're beaten horribly, that's horrific too. You know what I'm saying? So
sure.
I don't know which is worse. I don't know which was worse for me because they were both bad. They were just so bad. And so getting back a little bit on child abuse there, people out there who are listening, whether you're physically, mentally, emotionally, sexually, or neglected of all those abuses that we speak of, it's never right. Only you can determine which is worse if you want to. They're all bad. And it's all trauma. It's all traumatic. And I saw in print again the other day, Bill, I happened to open up, I actually found a magazine. You don't find magazines anymore, do you? But I found one they were talking about, and it's online too, where they're saying that child abuse, especially severe child abuse, is equal to that of a soldier in line, okay, in the front line. Because you see that they're both so traumatic, so terribly traumatic, that it just ruins the spirit so often. And that's why many of the soldiers, and they recognized that first, especially after World War II, they realized that so many of the soldiers were coming back, they were acting strange, all kinds of things were happening, and then finally it was diagnosed a few years after that when PTSD, of course that's post-traumatic stress disorder, came in to be in play, where they said that this person, a soldier goes off to war. He's not a murderer at heart. But, when you go into war, at times you have to, you have to kill someone. You have to kill the enemy. And that's just the way it is. And many times people find that terribly, terribly traumatic. With a child is sexually abused or physically, mentally, emotionally, maybe all of them, whatever. And that child is going through the same type of abuse that they neither one want to do what's being done. They don't want it being done to them, and they don't want to do it, to someone else. And they go through the same type of horror, the same type of trauma. So now they're saying they're both like on the same level. That's what studies show. And that's where, post-traumatic stress disorder comes from. And, of course, the same thing with a soldier. Think of our soldiers, what they're going through. Complex PTSD, so often they come home with. And that's from repetitive type of behavior, you know, where they have to do what they have to do, and certainly being shot at themselves. Anything that's repetitive, then it turns into complex, PTSD. That's what child abuse and also what our soldiers go through, too. So we're living in a heck of a world, aren't we?
We are lucky because there is an acknowledgement, at least with the minority group, which we belong to, that recovery is possible, and there's support for us. It's our own support, but there is support for us. And, of course, many of us can also engage and can afford treatment with therapists and so forth, and groups and medications. And I've never done that, but some people do. And, all of these are valid. They're all valid. There's nothing somebody has to do, but there's nothing somebody can't do as well. So, we want to encourage people to do whatever they can. But we're lucky is the point that we live in this era, because there's more knowledge. There's more of an acceptance of the premise that children who were abused in childhood will grow up to experience trauma in their teenage and young adult years, and that won't go away just because you want to wish it away. You have to work on it, and it's usually better to work on it in a group of some sort. So here's the group, NASCA.org, where you can be a member of the NASCA family for free and use all the tools for free, and we love each other and we support each other.
Absolutely. Well, we had a different kind of show tonight, Bill. But, for people out there who are drug addicts, who are alcoholics, maybe they're dually addicted, and they came from backgrounds such as we did, maybe not the same, but, from traumatic backgrounds, you're not alone. That's one thing you have to learn, too, is you're not alone. And if you did turn to alcohol and drugs, you're just, there's so many people that did do that and maybe even continue to do that. And but there is all kinds of help out there now, like Bill said. And, you can certainly come to NASCA. You can speak to us, on the contact list. Go to the contact list. I'm there. I'm the night owl. And this guy was laughing because I'm the night owl, and that's what I am. I'm up until 3, 4 o'clock in the morning many times, more often than not. And, we can speak about, and Bill had mentioned, we talk about everything on this show. We absolutely do. And we've been through it so often, okay? So you're not alone. You do have some place to turn to. You do have NASCA. You do have our satellite. I call them satellite programs for recovery. So there's a lot of things that you can do, on your own. And certainly do look at the website, really open up, go under those red bars and open them up, because there's a menu of all different kinds of things that you can learn from, okay? So this show is over. I'm getting the cue in my ear. But the point is, we do have a wonderful website. And thank you for listening. Bill, you're a pleasure. Yes, you are. My God. And it was good talking about what we spoke about tonight with the alcohol, because so many people are doing the same thing that we did.
Okay, well, listen, Lisa Zarconi is going to be our guest tomorrow night. She's a fabulous advocate for NASCA and for child abuse issues, especially child safety issues, and so I hope that people will tune in to talk to her. Of course, she's also an author and so forth. So Lisa Zarconi from Massachusetts is our guest tomorrow night. Then we need a guest for Friday night. So if anybody out there would like to be a guest, we got a slot for you. And we're going to have quite a few of them, Carol, in the next few weeks. So look at the – anybody who wants to can look at the schedule from now on. They're going to find quite a few slots they can fit themselves into. So thank you, Carol, for being here with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, we had a good talk. Yes, we did. We absolutely did. Okay, and I think we probably were able to help a lot of people who are just like us. That's what I think.
Right.
So.
Right.
Well, good night. God bless. And everybody out there, take care. Watch your back and watch your neighbor's back, too. Okay? And we'll be here tomorrow night. Good night now.
I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was long. You are forgotten after all that you've done. Blog Talk Radio.